let the people know that, you know, their own citizens are stuck there. And for me, I just don't know why. I mean, why, with my minimal resources, I was able to escape. You know, I put myself at a grave risk and danger, but it was the only option I had.
Well, Mokhtar Akhundzadeh, I want to thank you for being with us, Bay Area community activist and entrepreneur who traveled to his family's homeland, Yemen, in December 2014 to work with coffee farmers. After Saudi Arabia began bombing Yemen in March, he was unable to leave and reportedly received no help from the U.S. State Department, which closed the embassy in Yemen in February. Akhundzadeh eventually escaped Yemen by sea and finally returned to the United States on Tuesday. That does it for our program. We have job opening. We're hiring a social media producer, full-time job. Please visit our website for details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mata, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, Sam Riddell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Brood, and Vesta Godars. Kieran Craig Meadows, Jose Miranda are our camera folks. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to support the African American Alliance in collaboration with the YWCA of Greater Portland in coordinating a community unity event featuring special guests, Mrs. Sabrina Fulton, mother of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, who was attacked and murdered in 2012. Mrs. Fulton will share her powerful inspirational message on empowering our youth. The program will be held on Monday, April 13th from 6:45 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church. Please plan to arrive by 6:15 since seating is limited. This program will include spoken word, poetry, and music from our youth and other community members. Monday, April 13th, 6:45 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Just this for Trey.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Legislature heard testimony today on a bill that would limit the use of solitary confinement for people suffering from mental health issues.
TriMet has proposed a fare hike for senior citizens and disabled riders.
And on KBOO News In Depth, we'll speak with State Representative Lou Frederick about a slew of bills introduced in the state legislature dealing with police profiling, body cameras, and other accountability issues.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 9th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. A bill introduced in the Oregon legislature this week would limit the use of solitary confinement in Oregon prisons for people suffering from mental health issues. The bill was introduced by Senator Chip Shields from Portland. It would require the state to ensure that inmates in the state prison's behavioral health unit spend 7 hours a day out of their cells. Here's some of the testimony from the committee hearing on this bill.
To inform you of the results of our investigation and why we feel that this bill would address some of the problems that we discovered. And so I will introduce to you Sarah Radcliffe and Joel Greenberg, who are both staff attorneys at Disability Rights Oregon, and tell you more about that investigation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm going to talk very briefly about what the investigation that we did conduct. In the spring of 2014, we received several complaints that alleged abuse and neglect of prisoners with serious mental illness in the Behavioral Health Unit, which is a unit of specialized housing at the Oregon State Penitentiary. You would need to understand why we did this. You would need to understand what the BHU is. It was originally designed to provide very intensive mental health services, support, and treatment to the most seriously mentally ill individuals in the prison system. These were people, prisoners, who, due to their mental illness, were not able to conform their behavior to prison rules. They were not responsive to the graduated system of punishments and privileges that are used to deter behavior, alter behavior elsewhere in the prison. And typically, they would cycle again and again through periods of punishment followed by acting out, exacerbation of symptoms, severe decompensation, and another cycle of punishment. And each part of the cycle reinforced the other, and some of these men had been through those circles many, many times. So we need, first of all, to commend the Oregon Department of Corrections for determining, understanding that this was not very productive for their staff. It exposed them to danger. And it was certainly very destructive for the prisoners who were going through these cycles. And because of that, they developed the Behavioral Health Unit. In any case, the complaints we received from prisoners, and we do get many, were very consistent and very concerning. And because of that, we determined that it was important to conduct an investigation. We did what we think is a very thorough one. We hope to publish a final report, which we will send to the committee within the next month or so. In order to complete this investigation, we interviewed prisoners. We interviewed almost 5,000 pages of medical and other records. And very importantly, we looked at videotapes of 7 cell extractions. These are instances of planned use of force where a prisoner is being forced to vacate a cell for various reasons. And the reason that those were important and that I'm mentioning them is that they allowed us to compare what we heard from admittedly very mentally ill individuals who had axes to grind in many instances, in every instance, with what we could actually see. And the videotapes were very revealing, and they convince us that despite the fact that the BHU was designed to help these individuals, over time, what has happened is that the unit no longer functions the way it used to, or at least the way it should. We've also corroborated to a great extent what the prisoners and videotapes told us by speaking to 9 former and current members of the clinical mental health staff who have either worked or are still working at the BHU. What our investigation revealed in very short order is that BHU prisoners spend months and sometimes years in a 6-by-10-foot cell. There is no natural light in the unit. There's no access to the outdoors or fresh air. The prisoners have very rare opportunities to speak with another person other than through a wall to the cellmate next door. They're all in individual cells. Most are in their cells for 23 hours a day. Very few of them shower or take recreation regularly, even though DOC policies require that they be offered those opportunities daily.
That was testimony from Disability Rights Oregon about a bill in the Oregon legislature that would reduce the amount of time that prisoners with mental health issues can be forced to remain in solitary confinement.
Legal marijuana sales could start as early as July 1st this year if one Oregon legislator has his way. State Senator Ted Farioli first floated the idea this week. Current Oregon law calls for the State Liquor Control Commission to begin licensing adult-use stores in 2016. Yet possession and cultivation of marijuana by adults over age 21 in Oregon becomes legal on July 1st of this year. The question is how adults would get marijuana without having someone commit the crime of illegal sale. Ferrioli, who is the state Senate Republican leader, wants to allow state-licensed dispensaries to sell marijuana to any adult over the age of 21. Dispensaries are currently allowed to sell to any legally registered medical marijuana patient over the age of 18. Ferrioli's proposal is still being drafted, and no legislation has yet been introduced. The senator is a member of the legislature's Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. The co-chair of the Measure 91 committee, Democratic State Representative Van Leninger, has expressed concerns that the move could disrupt the rollout of legal adult-use stores, but said that committee members are interested in Ferrioli's proposal.
Backers of Measure 91 that legalized recreational marijuana use in Oregon have now joined forces with the Bus Project on a campaign to support the passage of House Bill 3372. This would allow people convicted of nonviolent marijuana crimes to have those convictions expunged from their criminal records. The Fresh Start Oregon campaign was kicked off on March 31st to support the bill introduced to the Oregon House back in February by Democrat Lou Frederick of Portland. The bill would also reduce sentences for people currently incarcerated for marijuana-related offenses. House Bill 3372 has not yet been scheduled for a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee. The Fresh Start Oregon campaign encourages supporters of the bill to sign a petition and contact their legislators to express support. More information is at thebusproject.org/freshstartoregon.
TriMet, the Portland area's public transit system, is proposing to raise fares for riders who are disabled or senior citizens. The Transit Riders Union and other groups are organizing to oppose the fare hike. I spoke with Lou Church of the Progressive Student Union to find out more.
Well, the proposal is that in the last week of May, which is a couple months away, so there's time to organize against the fare hike, it's to raise fares for a select specific category of transit riders, what the TriMet calls honored citizens. We're arguing that by raising the fares just for seniors and just for disabled riders, they're actually kind of dishonoring the citizens, in particular because TriMet has a $500 million budget and counting capital costs like the Orange Line, they have a $1 billion budget. The fare proposal, which goes to the unelected board of directors of TriMet that last week of May, is not that much. So their idea is, it's kind of the frog in boiling water theory, that by raising fares a little bit, people won't notice or won't think it's important or won't think these populations are important. The proposal is 25 cents more per ride or $2 more for an honored citizen monthly pass. Well, TriMet, we've dealt with TriMet for years organizing on riders' issues. Like, we turned in 1,400 signatures on petitions to keep Fairless Square, but the unelected board voted to get rid of Fairless Square a few years ago. And our experience is that TriMet looks at things through, I don't know, it looks at them backwards and it doesn't really address rider needs at all, or even the idea of the commons, that TriMet is public transit and therefore is part of the community. That was our big argument with Fairless Square. In this particular proposed fare hike, there's a lack of information, we would argue. They only think they're going to raise $600,000 out of this fare hike. So why do they need $600,000 when they have a $500 million budget? Doesn't make sense. There's no explanation so far of whose idea was it. What are they going to spend it on? More executive salaries? That's been a big issue with the general manager and some of the senior staff. There's also the issue of just, is this a vulnerable population? Do we think in Portland that seniors and people who are disabled are moving here in droves as older folks, as there's an article in the Tribune about that, who may be affluent and retiring kind of the palm trees of the north, and so therefore if they take public transportation as an option, they're going to have plenty of money to pay higher fares. Our argument is that there are vulnerable populations and that prices are going up in other areas, which is paradoxical at best, because the economy statistically is supposed to be far better now with unemployment at 5% or so. For example, there's some nonprofit landlords downtown that are in Portland who are raising rents by approximately $300 per month. Well, if you indeed are on a limited income as a senior or a disabled person, that's a lot of money. If you have you know, $50,000 a year, then these sort of small increases, either for transit fares or rent increases, presumably you would own something as opposed to pay rent. Those are that much. It's kind of what Barbara Ehrenreich talked about in Nickel and Dime. You try to nickel and dime people, even when, you know, the argument isn't even that there's austerity and TriMet's doing cutbacks. They're expanding. They have plenty of money. So we hope to, we're circulating petitions, and we hope to gather enough signatures and groups, anti-poverty groups, community groups, unions, churches throughout the metro region to effectively get 3 of the 5 votes on the TriMet board to vote this proposal down. There's 2 vacancies. There's normally 7 people on the board. Our long-range goal is to have the board elected, but that's not the immediate project. The immediate project is to stop the fare hike.
Now, where can people find out more and how can they get involved in organizing or in participating in organizing on this?
There's weekly meetings at Portland State at the Square Table at Chit Chat Cafe. It's next to Hot Lips Pizza on Green Max, 1907 Southwest 6th. Those are at 4 p.m. every Saturday. There's also email and phone contacts if that's helpful. 503-222-2974, and that's voicemail if you don't get a person. Email, it's letters and numbers, P.O.B., like post office box, P.O.B. 40011 at juno.com. We're also doing outreach to different groups, but of course it's much easier for individual radio listeners to be able to contact us. This week we've given 2 talks so far, Monday night to Jobs at Justice, which is a group representing about 60 unions who seemed pretty opposed to a fare increase, even though workers may have more money than seniors or disabled folks, or you're not counting senior workers or disabled workers. And we talked to Northwest Neighbors last night, which is a coalition of 8 neighborhood organizations on the west side. And we can also send speakers to different groups as well.
What do you have coming up next?
We're looking to do, we did a protest, actually, which I think Channel 6 and KBOO, I'm not sure about print media covered, we did a picket of the Portland Business Alliance when the last time that TriMet did a fare increase and cut services. We had about 20 people, so that was reasonable. We weren't trying to get hundreds, although we're hopeful to have more people. We're evaluating, the reason we chose Portland Business Alliance is they were very pushy for cutting services and raising fares last time. We haven't seen them take a position on this specific fare increase, although we noticed that Bernie Bottomley, who used to be and was the head of the PBA, pushing that initiative. PBA also has been involved with trying to keep homeless people from sleeping on sidewalks, among other things. Bernie Bottomley got hired after that push to cut Fairless Square as public affairs director for TriMet. So we think PBA might be a possible target. But we also know, and we've gone to the new TriMet office, which has no logo or notification that it's even the TriMet office. It's downtown by the Hawthorne Bridge. So those are 2 possible picketing locations we're looking at.
I'm speaking with Lou Church, the coordinator at the Progressive Student Union at Portland State University. Lou, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for talking to Transit Riders Union. Thank you.
Indeed. This Bye. Is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
The University of Oregon is under scrutiny again as new rules regarding the privacy of counseling records popped up. The new policy affects the way that the university accesses students' confidential medical records. The most alarming of the charges was the removal of written consent requirements. Privacy advocates are concerned because this means that the school may access records without the consent of the person whose records they are using. The university had promised a revision of the privacy policy after it was criticized for pulling a student's medical records to leverage themselves in a lawsuit. The university ultimately dropped their suit against a rape victim, but contended that because the counseling services were provided by the school, that they owned the records. Counselors, students, and instructors expressed distrust in that policy, stating that it violates doctor-patient confidentiality. The University of Oregon has received a lot of negative attention in relation to sexual misconduct and privacy in the past, including the hiring of a motivational speaker for the football team that was a sex offender. The university maintains that the standards of the new rules are based on other existing models in the country.
The city of Seattle is taking a new approach to criminal justice that is showing great promise and which research shows is effective at reducing reoffending. The Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, or LEAD, began in Seattle in 2011. I spoke with Chris Nerup of the Public Defender Association to find out more. I'm speaking with Chris Nerup. He's the program director at the Public Defender Association in Seattle, Washington. Now, Chris, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program is active up there in Seattle. Could you explain something about the program first?
Sure. So the main thing about LEAD is that it is a multi-jurisdictional collaborative effort designed to address problems associated with outdoor drug use, drug sales, and prostitutions at the street level, which has been an issue of concern for residents, business owners, community members, law enforcement, for a long, long time up here. And what was happening was that the Seattle Police Department, like many police departments around the country, had one tool they were using, which was to arrest people and take them to jail. And that clearly was not working. It was not working for pretty much any of the involved community members. And so in 2011, we launched this pilot project as an alternative to sort of criminal justice system as normal, where low-level drug offenders or people arrested on prostitution charges are offered a referral to case management instead of going to jail.
Really stands in complete contrast to something like the broken windows approach, where you arrest everyone who's committing any minor offense, any petty offense, and put them through the system.
Correct, exactly. And what's interesting is that it's similar to broken windows in the sense that you definitely want to address issues out on the street, but whereas broken windows approach is relies entirely on sanctions, people up here realized that the sanction-driven approach was not working at all, and it had not been working. It didn't matter how many people were arrested and prosecuted and sent to jail. There were still people out on the street with problems. And so the approach here is to deal with all of this as a public health issue and get public safety outcomes through that approach.
Now, at the University of Washington, Professor Susan Collins has been leading research on the impact of LEAD and its effectiveness. They've just issued a new report. Could you tell us something about the results?
Sure. So the nice thing about this is that they are operating completely independently of us. It's a team of researchers from the University of Washington, and they have completely independent funding. So they have no dog in this fight. And they just released their results yesterday of their recidivism evaluation, which was a direct comparison of people who were diverted into LEAD versus criminal justice system as normal. And so one of the most startling findings of their evaluation was the dramatic decline in new arrests and new charges of people who had been diverted into LEAD as opposed to those who were just dealt with in the traditional manner.
Right, 60% is just tremendous.
Yeah, 60% reduction in the recidivism.
Right on. And really, for a lot of the general public, the question of rehabilitation and reentry programs and the rest, it all comes down to reoffending. Will they? Will these people commit another crime?
And that's right. Just... And the startling thing about this is that this approach, which again relies on a public health harm reduction based approach, is yielding better results than almost any other program that we're aware of out there, especially ones like Drug Court or others that rely on a sanctions-driven approach. So this really, you know, gives a lot of impetus to trying something like LEAD, which relies on referring people into community-based case management services rather than, you know, something, a court-monitored program.
And just to reemphasize the fact, when we're talking about the control group of people in the traditional system, King County, Seattle has drug courts. You have these so-called problem-solving courts. So the people they're being compared to may have been put into those programs.
That's correct. And in fact, one of the interesting things about LEAD that has happened over time was when we first started, we said that someone could not be in LEAD and drug court at the same time so that we wouldn't get some sort of cross-contamination going on. on. But what's happened is that people have been failing out of drug court, and the judges have said, can you guys take them into lead? Because you're getting better results with your approach than we are with ours.
This is terrific. Hopefully other communities will start looking at your results.
We certainly hope so. The results are extremely positive, and we've, even prior to the evaluation, we've had interest from numerous jurisdictions around the country, and we're really hoping that the results will encourage other folks to look at programs like LEAD.
I want to thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all that you're doing. I've been speaking with Chris Nierup. He's the program director at the Public Defender Association in Seattle, Washington. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
An African-American woman will head to a California court today for the felony charge of lynching. Miley Hampton, a 20-year-old civil rights activist, was at a police brutality protest in Sacramento, California, last January when she attempted to pull a fellow protester from the clutches of police forces. This act is referred to as lynching and was put on the books in California back in 1933 as a way to prosecute members of a mob trying to take someone out of the police's protection in order to exact a vigilante justice. That law, however, has been used in recent years by police and prosecutors to arrest and convict protesters and activists. The historically painful context of the word lynching has not been lost on Hampton or Kevin Johnson, Sacramento's mayor. Shortly after Hampton's arrest, Mayor Johnson asked the state legislators to take the term out of the penal code, saying that, quote, the word lynching has a long and painful history in our nation. If Hampton is convicted of the felony count, she could face up to 4 years in prison for it. Most previous cases involving protesters, such as during the Occupy movement, have been dropped.
A black trans man in Georgia has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for killing his rapist in self-defense. 20-year-old Kai Peterson was raped outside a convenience store in 2011. After shooting his attacker in self-defense, he was arrested and charged with armed robbery and murder, despite DNA tests confirming he was raped. Peterson spent the next year in prison and was unable to see an attorney, despite state law requiring access to legal counsel within 72 hours. Peterson then took a plea deal for involuntary manslaughter in hopes of a shorter sentence, but was still given 20 years in jail. According to The Advocate, Peterson has been able to speak with a trans advocacy group and may get medically necessary hormone therapy from Georgia's Department of Corrections. For more information on Peterson's case, visit freeingkai, that's K-Y, .wordpress.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with State Representative Lou Frederick about the police accountability bills he has introduced to the Oregon State Legislature, followed by Rose City Native Radio's one-year anniversary retrospective at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 62 and a low of 42 and a 20% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant at the Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, effectively ending the Civil War. In 1948, fighters with the Zionist paramilitary groups in Irgun and Lehi attacked the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin in an attempt to lift the blockade of Jerusalem, killing 107 out of the 600 inhabitants. And in 2003, Baghdad fell to coalition forces during the invasion of Iraq, which began the Iraq War. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein went into hiding with many members of his government, and Iraqi citizens reacted by destroying many symbols of his 24-year reign. The quote of the day is from birthday boy Tom Lehrer. Life is like a sewer. What you get out of it depends on what you put into it.
It's 5:28, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Come one, come all. step right up and buy your ticket for a ride on the splendiferous, phantasmagoric, supersonic, miraculous Trans-Pacific Partnership. TPP is not some sort of futuristic flying machine, but yet another global trade scam coming at us like a volcanic eruption straight out of hell. This thing is a partnership of, by, and for global corporations, similar to NAFTA, only much, much, much bigger and far more destructive, both to the middle class and to our people's sovereignty. Negotiating in strict secrecy during the past 7 years, a cabal of the Obama White House and corporate lobbyists are now ready to spring it on us, and Republican leaders intend to ram it into law before we, the people, can get a whiff of its anti-democratic stench. Indeed, to perfume it, they've already begun a PR campaign touting TPP as the long-sought wonder cure for America's downtrodden working class. For example, such odd bedfellow boosters as Secretary of State John Kerry and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce both exclaim that the 12-nation scheme will, quote, support 650,000 new jobs. Wow, really? No. In January, the Washington Post fact-checker column dug into that number and found that it was miscalculated and misleading. In fact, the columnist found that, quote, the correct number is zero. He also pointed out that even if 650,000 jobs were created, that's not even a drop in the bucket, for it would increase U.S. employment by less than one-half of 1%. This is Jim Hightower saying, be alert, friends, for the TPP gang will try to dazzle us with hokey numbers and neon lies while they turn our future well-being over to global corporations. To get information and get involved, go to citizen.org/trade.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Supporters of longtime political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal have called for a national day of action this Friday on Mumia's behalf. Mumia was rushed to the intensive care unit of a Pennsylvania hospital last week, suffering from diabetic shock. Abu-Jamal is reported to have passed out in custody in his cell and remained under armed guard while shackled to his hospital bed. Initially, his family was denied visitation, but a pressure campaign resulted in their being allowed a short visit. Mumia's wife said that her husband was being severely mistreated and accused prison officials of trying to kill him slowly with medical neglect. Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in 1982, despite overwhelming evidence of his innocence. He was on death row in Pennsylvania until 2012, when his death sentence was overturned and a sentence of life in prison without parole was imposed instead. His original trial for the death of Faulkner has been roundly criticized by legal observers and international human rights organizations, citing outright bias of the judge. While in custody, Abu-Jamal has become a reporter and critic of the prison industrial complex, while police interest organizations and political leaders have sought to silence him, most recently through a bill passed in the state legislature that makes most public talks by prisoners illegal. Professor Cornel West today issued this appeal on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Brother Cornel West, the life of my dear brother, brilliant journalist, intellectual, and political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, is in great danger. Chronic medical neglect and malpractice by prison staff led to his diabetic shock last week and continued denial of proper health care and diet for his life-threatening illness. Join a national day of action to stop the medical execution of my dear brother Mumia on Friday, April the 10th. Meanwhile, keep calling Pennsylvania officials to demand that he get treatment by specialists of his choosing, the correct diet, and daily visits by his precious family, friends, and attorneys. For details on events near you and phone numbers of officials to call, go to freemumia.com or prisonradio.org or bringmumiahome.com.
Free Mumia, from the hands of the down presser. Free Mumia, free Mumia.
Last month, the United States added the lowest number of new jobs in over a year as the economy continues to slow down.
The official growth rate was 0.2% on an annual basis, barely above recession levels. The official unemployment rate stayed at 5.5%. The United States needs to add 140,000 new jobs per month just to keep pace with population growth. Last month, 126,000 jobs were reported, but more than 277,000 people were dropped from the labor market. If people get too discouraged to keep actively looking and applying for jobs, they're dropped from the labor market employment statistics. In other words, the unemployment rate has dropped recently because the labor force shrunk. Many economic experts use the labor force participation rate as a more accurate rate of the true unemployment rate. If the economy was in recovery, the labor force would be growing and the labor force participation rate would be rising. The labor force participation rate includes all adults up to 64 years of age. The current labor force participation rate has fallen to a 36-year low of 62.7% employed. The last time the labor force participation rate was this low was in 1978, when many families relied on only one income. Historically, economic recovery periods after a recession add an average of 300,000 jobs per month, with some months adding more than 1 million new jobs. During the recent economic recovery following the 2008 crash, new jobs have averaged less than 200,000 per month. About 90% of all new jobs added are low-paying service sector jobs. Wage growth averaged around 2%, the same as the inflation rate, keeping true wage growth non-existent.
Today, the Board of Trustees for Pennsylvania State University authorized additional settlements to more of the victims in the child abuse cases involving former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. The board held a special telephone meeting and voted 18-6 to approve the settlements. The dollar amounts are not yet being disclosed. The number of additional settlements is also being kept confidential. Officials say that they may release that information at a later date after the settlements have been agreed to by the victims and finalized. Penn State settled with 26 other victims in 2013, paying out almost $60 million. There are reportedly still three active civil suits against Sandusky, who was convicted in 2012 on 45 charges of child abuse and given a sentence of 30 to 60 years in prison.
A new report has found that the increased use of solar power can benefit both utility companies and private individuals. In recent years, there's been tremendous growth in the use of solar panels, both with giant farms and small rooftop installations. Big utilities have campaigned to end the practice of selling power back to the grid, known as net metering. These companies argue that because of the loss of grid power sold to these customers, the power infrastructure cannot be adequately maintained. However, there are groups like the Rocky Mountain Institute that think both the utilities and customers can benefit from the increased use of solar power. RMI has released a new report, The Economics of Load Defection, that details how a large number of customers who use less energy and don't want to disconnect from the grid entirely will still support the grid system. The report projects that through 2050, the most economical system for the customer would evolve over time from grid-only to grid plus solar to grid plus solar plus battery. They studied the economics in five U.S. cities: Los Angeles, Honolulu, San Antonio, Louisville, Kentucky, and New York City. The group found that grid plus solar systems were economically feasible in three of the five cities today and would be feasible in the other two within a decade. This is not good news for the utility industry because as more and more customers become self-sufficient and leave the grid, the cost of upkeep will have to be shared by the fewer remaining energy users still connected. It remains to be seen how the utilities will respond, but the economics of solar power systems is now leading the trend towards small-scale local generation of power.
Wisconsin has banned its public land staffers from discussing climate change. The three-member panel overseeing the Wisconsin Commission of Public Lands voted 2-1, with two Republicans supporting and one Democrat dissenting. The vote prevents officials who manage income-producing land from discussing how climate change impacts that land. This includes wildfires, droughts, and insects affecting land with investments linked to public schools. State Treasurer and Republican Matt Adamczyk told Bloomberg Business, "It's not part of our sole mission, which is to make money for our beneficiaries. That's what I want our employees working on, managing our trust funds." But Wisconsin Secretary of State Doug La Follette, the only Democrat and lone dissenter on the panel, said that having been on this board for close to 30 years, he had never seen such nonsense. Wisconsin is the second state to ban officials from discussing the impact of climate change. In March, EPA officials in Florida said that Governor Rick Scott prohibited the words climate change and global warming.
Police and government agencies alike have been using a technology known as FLIR for several years to see thermal images of all kinds. FLIR stands for Forward-Looking Infrared, and the company that makes it markets its thermal binoculars and cameras all over the world. But this month, the Oregon-based company agreed to pay a $9.5 million fine for bribery. FLIR has been accused of using gifts and trips to lure Saudi Arabian business. Two employees of the Dubai office of FLIR used company money to deliver watches and trips to influential Saudi public figures. At the time of the bribes, FLIR profited over $7 million from sales influenced by the bribes.
In a press conference in the Saudi capital of Riyadh on Tuesday, United States Deputy Secretary of State Anthony Blinken told reporters the U.S. has expedited weapons shipments to Saudi Arabia in support of the now two-week-old Saudi-led offensive on Yemen, dubbed Operation Decisive Storm. According to Secretary Blinken, the U.S. has increased intelligence sharing with the Saudi kingdom and has established a coordination and planning center inside Saudi Arabia to support the 10-member Saudi-led coalition. Meanwhile, a report in today's Washington Post cited analysts and residents who claim that the coalition airstrikes have done little to stop the advance of Houthi rebels, nor move the coalition closer to its stated goal of returning exiled President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi to power. Aid agencies continue to warn of a looming health crisis in Yemen, where at least 600 people, 74 of them children, have reportedly been killed since the beginning of the offensive. Nearly 2,000 people have been injured, according to the World Health Organization, and UNICEF reports more than 100,000 people have been displaced by the fighting.
A high court in Pakistan has ordered police to file criminal charges against two U.S. officials for their role in a drone strike 6 years ago that killed a number of civilians. The officials are Jonathan Banks, the agency's former station chief in Pakistan, who left the country in 2010 after he was exposed as a spy, and John Rizzo, the former general counsel for the CIA. According to the Pakistani government's lawyer, this means that the families of those killed in drone strikes in Pakistan now have a right to proceed in similar criminal actions against the CIA.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, April 9th, 2015. Israeli settlers destroy Palestinian farmlands in the West Bank and in Gaza. Public workers go on strike to protest delayed in salaries. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A group of Israeli extremists from an illegal Israeli outpost started on Thursday to dig a road on Palestinian lands to link it with their outpost in Al-Khadr town near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The mayor, Tawfiq Salah, said that the assailants started digging the road in Ain al-Qassis area near their illegal Sidi Bouaz outpost. Salah added that the local residents noticed the attackers and managed to stop them after they'd leveled nearly 200 meters of lands. The officials said that completing this road would lead to an illegal appropriation of an entire mountain of approximately 100 acres of Palestinian lands and would also deny the Palestinians access to their lands nearby. The area has been subjected to frequent attacks that also include illegal annexation of lands assaults on farmers and uprooting dozens of trees. Israel has been trying to illegally annex large areas of Palestinian lands, especially since Al-Khadr is near the Jerusalem-Hebron Road, as Tel Aviv is aiming at using the lands in its so-called Greater Jerusalem Colonist Project that extends in the area to the north parts of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Earlier on Thursday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded Kabatia town near the northern West Bank city of Jenin and kidnapped one Palestinian. Soldiers also invaded Beit Fajar south of Bethlehem and searched homes there. Elsewhere, the Public Workers Union in the Gaza Strip announced a general strike Thursday across all public institutions in protest against the government's continued failure to pay salaries to tens of thousands of employees of the former Hamas government. The strike announcement signals a renewed determination by public workers to pressure the Hamas Fatah Unity government to address the seeming crisis over the workers, whose future has been uncertain since the April 2014 Unity deal. In December, meanwhile, Israel froze some $127 million in tax funds owed to the Palestinian Authority in revenge of the PA's decision to join the International Criminal Court. The move has added to the lack of funds facing Palestinian authorities and has led to major salary problems for even recognized employees of the Palestinian Authority.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh, Alan Monticello, Tarina Aguilar, and Ethan Martin. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now!, a news magazine hosted by award-winning journalist Amy Goodman. At 8 on